Bobby.
I do feel like when I was in my early 20s, anything that was like adulting, we didn't call it back then, but felt like a really big accomplishment. Like, yes, I figured out how to do laundry myself. Like, yes, I know how to like buy stuff in a supermarket now. Yeah. Doesn't feel like, I try to remind myself sometimes that like I'm still like achieving all those things. Yeah. It just doesn't feel like an achievement because routine. I do it all the time.
Yeah, that's what bullet journaling is for. It makes adulting feel like an achievement.
Okay. It's not such a distraction, right? Because I was just talking to somebody about going back to school. And so they're like my age. And they're like, well, you know, like I'm almost 40. I don't want to go back to school. And I'm like, hey, I'm going for my bachelor's right now. And I'm going to be 40 when I graduate, potentially. And I'm like, no, it's the best. Going back to school is great because all you have to worry about is school. Where, like, everyone around you who's in their 20s are like, oh, I didn't have food in my fridge, and now I feel lightheaded, and, like, I'm going through, like, a breakup, and I'm, and I can't focus on my studies. And you're just like, oh, I figured all that stuff out, and now I just need to worry about this essay. That's
so
all
true.
I have to worry about.
That's so true. Oh, my gosh. That's so true.
Welcome to the Trade Waiters. Once again, we have our special guest, Faith Erin Hicks, for this
Hello.
Episode as well. And this time we're doing Drifting Dragons by Taku Kuwabara. We're going to do volume 1 and 2.
So are we going to do another character revealing question?
What food did you hate as a child that you now eat as an adult?
So I can start. I'm Jam. I never used to like zucchini, but I figured out a way finally to prepare it that I don't hate.
Oh, how do you prepare it?
You cut it into matchsticks and you can stir fry it. And you
don't
have to stir fry it for very long. It gets mushy very quickly.
Yeah.
But it's actually pretty good, very lightly cooked.
Yeah, like I actually started roasting zucchini and I really like it. I kind of like it mushy. But yeah, I've never really eaten it raw or anything. But it tastes really good when it's roasted.
Yeah. So, it's my
name. I'm Jeff Ellis, and I'm going to say Brussels sprouts, just because as a kid, I hated Brussels sprouts. I was lucky in that my mom also hated Brussels sprouts, so we only had to deal with it at my grandmother's house. And what I realized later is that my grandmother was very British, so she would just boil the Brussels sprouts until they had no flavor, and that's why they were terrible. And so, like, later, I've learned that, if you cut Brussels sprouts up and fry them in butter and maybe throw a little bacon in there, they're very tasty. Just don't boil them until they're mush.
Have you ever seen a Brussels sprout stalk?
No.
They're so weird.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like a big long thing and like the Brussels
what?
Are on them. Yeah, it's not what you would expect.
Oh, that's weird.
I'm Jonathan, and I think my biggest food accomplishment in that respect would be cauliflower. Mm. Like, I'm still not a fan of broccoli. No thanks. But cauliflower is like one of the main ingredients in aloo gobi. And like my version of aloo gobi is probably nothing like it's supposed to be, but it's like it's got potatoes, it's got cauliflower, it's curry, and it's really good. And you can't make it without cauliflower. So now I have a bunch of cauliflower in my fridge.
Here, you want to hear my favorite way to make cauliflower? So chop it up, lightly coat in olive oil, put a bit of salt and a bit of turmeric, a lot of turmeric, just roast it in the oven, and that's an amazing way to make cauliflower.
Oh, that sounds really good. I'll have to try that. I'm Faith, and I feel like all vegetables, of course, we could always use more vegetables in our diets, but I hated salad, I hated lettuce, anything in a salad, I hated as a child. And the only vegetable I would voluntarily eat was, like, raw carrots. And, you know, now I feel like I've just gotten better, and I eat salads for lunch every day because I'm a cartoonist and I sit on my butt all the time, and it's like, you know, gotta find a lunch that's healthy. So, I don't know. I feel very much like an adult when I'm, like, eating my salad, and I'm like, this is fine. You know? I mean, the reality is a salad is never going to taste as good as a pizza, but a salad makes me feel a lot better than a pizza.
Okay, do we want to talk about Taku Kuwabara?
Drifting Dragon. I think these are the only ones out in English so far. I don't think Volume 3 is out.
Oh.
Yeah, it was when I was ordering it, it was like very new.
Yeah. So a couple years ago, I think 2018, when I was at WonderCon, Deb Aoki, who is someone who is very knowledgeable about manga, reviews, and she gave me a copy of the first volume of this in Japanese, and basically was like, you know, this is a comic that I think you might be interested in. And I thought the art was really gorgeous, but, you know, I'm not able to read Japanese, and it's always really frustrating to read a comic when you just can't understand what's going on. Like, with a comic, you can kind of guess, because you do have the images, but it's just not the same. But yeah, I was really excited to read it in English. I don't know what I was expecting. It was, but I ended up really enjoying it. I feel like this is, maybe, it is a little bit similar to Delicious and Dungeon, which we were talking about earlier, where it's like this fantasy world, and then it's like people cooking and eating fantasy things.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I really, really liked about this series is it is specifically focused on working people, you know, and it is focused on this sailing ship that, you know, sails through the skies of this magical world, and the crew of this sailing ship, and they hunt and kill and then butcher and sell dragons, and it's called Draking, I think that's how you pronounce it, Draking.
Or I think it might be Draking.
I had Draking in my head, but yeah. I have no basis for that.
All right, let's go with Draking, because that sounds better.
It's basically Moby Dick, but make it steampunk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here's what we know about Taku Kuwabara. He was born in 1985 in Hokkaido, and he's a Taurus.
That's all the internet has to say?
There we go.
Okay.
Those mysterious manga artists.
Yeah, like, it's so strange. I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm a full-time cartoonist, and it's, like, something that's really sort of drilled into us at, I feel like, an early age, as we were baby cartoonists coming new into the world, is you gotta promote. You know, you gotta put yourself out there, you gotta have all the social media, you gotta constantly be posting, you know, you gotta do cons, you gotta, you know, present yourself as this professional person that other people should be interested in order for them to buy your work and read your work, hopefully. And yeah, it seems very, very different in Japan, and but I find that fascinating. I don't know. I'm sure there are advantages and disadvantages to both ways of doing it. I wish I, as a cartoonist who is, you know, has to be, you know, public facing and has to, like, present herself as a professional person, I wish I had to do less of that. Like, I wish I wish that was not a huge component of my job. Although now at this point I have come to accept it.
I feel like Seth has the right idea, where you just need to make up, like, a pen name.
A persona.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that's
character.
Just, that is who you are at conventions, that is who you are on the title of the book, but then you could still step out of that and be, like, a civilian with a different name and a different identity.
Sort of a reverse Superman.
Yeah.
I don't... But with him, it's like, I feel like he dresses like that every day.
Oh, I mean, maybe that's a bad example. He just is Seth all the time. But he has that option. He could,
yes,
if he wanted
true.
To.
He could go to the grocery store in sweats. And,
yeah.
You know,
like
if he didn't want
to be bothered.
I doubt that he does.
So what you're saying is he's less of a Superman and more of a daredevil.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
he can't really separate himself from his persona.
Yeah. No, he goes to the grocery store in the full suit, and then he's like, excuse me, why is there not, unpasteurized milk in the glass? So I was just going to say, I thought you intended this, because I thought there was such a great theme between both picks.
I know, right? They're totally connected, but I didn't even think about
manga
that.
Manga about cooking and eating fantasy creatures.
Yeah.
That's both books.
Yeah. I will say, though, that this one is a very different vibe.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, and actually I think one of the things I did put in my notes, you guys can tell me what you think of this, but I actually kind of said, like, it feels kind of mean. Like, this series felt a little bit more mean-spirited. Like, the deaths of the dragons was a lot, like, grislier, and they go through into a lot of detail in the drawings of, like, how they butcher and prepare the dragons, and, like, Mika's, like, attitude is, like, he's a little too enthusiastic about eating dragon. Like, the same way I thought Leos was a little too enthusiastic about eating monsters, Mika just, every time he sees a dragon, he's, like, just licking his lips, like, oh, man. That thing's going to be so tasty.
Yeah. So it definitely doesn't get there in two volumes, but it makes me curious to know whether this series ever becomes a little bit more self-aware on that aspect. I don't have that answer. I don't know.
Yeah, I think we were talking about this earlier, but I it's fairly newly published in English, and I think there's only two volumes out. A third should be coming soon, but yeah.
I will echo and double down on that sentiment, Jeff. I've been a vegetarian for over 10 years. Delicious and Dungeon didn't bother me at all, despite it being about eating animals, but this one made me uncomfortable to read. And I struggled with it a little bit, I have to say.
I eat meat, and I was like, there's like when they killed they kill a dragon, and then it's established that that was the baby dragon, and now the mother's angry.
Yeah, it's very
then they
harsh.
Kill the mother, and I was like, oh, these people are really nasty people. Like, they killed the baby dragon, now they're killing the mother, and like Mika's just like, oh, the mother's gonna taste better than the baby. Like, can't wait to eat it.
Yeah, it definitely has a harsher edge to it, and I feel like the world in general is presented as being harsh, because, you know, these are people who, with the exception of Mika, who I feel like, I don't know. I don't quite understand this character at this point. Like, I feel like it's a little too early for him to... I don't know. I feel like he's still developing as a character, and maybe the author is deciding where to take him as a character. But, yeah, I feel like this is a world where this is their job. They're very, like... No one is sentimental in this job. They are these whalers, basically. It's like whaling, you know, and they're hunting down these great beasts of the sky and destroying them. And actually, I think it's actually really interesting how the dragons are drawn.
Oh, yeah. The dragon designs are fantastic.
Yeah, and they're drawn more... They look more like deep-sea creatures or amoebas. And they're drawn in a way that does not feel like a traditional dragon. Mm-hmm. And the majority of them don't seem to have, like, faces or eyes that sort of look human. Mm-hmm. And I feel like maybe that was a deliberate choice, because it might have been too harsh if they... were like, if it was like this expressive, like emotive creature. It's, you know, the part where it's like, oh, we killed the baby dragon and now we're going to kill the mother. But it's like they don't necessarily look like these creatures that, I don't know, it's hard to describe. But it's like, I feel like the design was maybe a deliberate choice to make them less empathetic as food or as creatures that are going to, throughout the course of this story, be killed and eaten.
Yeah.
No, I think there's definitely was a conscious choice to make the dragons a lot more alien.
Alien,
seeming.
Yeah, they look very alien.
I mean, even they have the little baby, like, micro dragon that was in a cage, and it looks very cute and it has a face.
Yeah.
But then, right before they kill it, it splits its face into four segments, and it has
and
this,
it's really
like
horrifying.
It's like that monster from Stranger Things, like
yeah.
with a giant like four pronged like fang engorged mouth, and suddenly you're like, oh. And so then when I think it was Mika like stabs it in the neck with a spear, you're kind of like, well, yeah, that was probably for the best.
Yeah, I also found it very interesting that the dragon portrayed in the cover is a very traditional, stereotypical-looking dragon.
Yeah.
And I want people who haven't read this book, even though we are spoiling it entirely, that's not what the dragons look like on the inside. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very obvious marketing choice, and it's fine. But, yeah, it surprised me that the designs of the dragons were so interesting, and I think probably one of the most interesting parts of this book were the novel and unique and well-rendered designs for the dragons.
Yeah,
I feel I'm bringing a lot of my own biases to this book, because I couldn't help but read it as like, this is an analogy for whaling. And to be fair, I think Faith is right that there's not really any evidence in the book that the dragons are the same as whales, that they're as smart as whales, that they have as sophisticated interactions with each other as whales. That's me putting something into the story that might not be the intention of the author. And I also, like, I'm feel sort of, like, conflicted, too, because I'm reading Moby Dick at the same time. That one doesn't, like, for the most part, there's a couple scenes that kind of bother me so far, but for the most part, the whaling in Moby Dick doesn't bother me as much as the draking in Drifting Dragons. And I'm not sure why.
Like, I mean, they are visual in this, so it's like you're yeah. literally seeing like the flesh removed from bones, mm-hmm. and you know, seeing things cooked. So
I'm not sure.
I mean, I always no.
Yeah, okay. I don't know.
I mean, I always have a stronger reaction to something visual mm-hmm. as opposed to like something written on the page.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because Moby Dick is set so far in the past. Maybe it's just because it's written in a really weird way where you're not really invested so much in whether or not they succeed at whaling, because you know that their ultimate goal is going to be portrayed as being a bad idea. Like, the Ahab is chasing this one whale for revenge, and so that's his motivation isn't pitched as being altruistic or just sort of neutral. Or is this... And we're only two volumes in, so I don't know where it's going to go, but at least so far it's kind of just like a day-to-day life. This is just a job. Like, we're not doing this for any other reason than this is just our livelihoods.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't really thought that through myself, but that's kind of where I'm thinking right now.
Yeah, I would actually echo that. I was going to bring up the whaling thing because I very early on was like, oh, it's whaling in the sky. And I think I'm bringing some baggage to this too, because when I was living in Japan, like, whaling was like a hot button topic, because every year Japan harvests the legal amount of whales that they're allowed to harvest for scientific research, and they've been doing so for like decades, and so far the research has still just come up with the fact that whales taste delicious with soy sauce. they use their scientific research as an excuse to continue whaling. And I watched like the movie The Cove, about the dolphin hunt that happens in Japan, and they're very critical of the way Japan handles like dealing with all cephalopods and cetaceans, and they're like flouting a lot of international agreements on trying to preserve whales. And this is Japan, their politics, but it's just like, so then I'm reading this as this kind of like romanticized vision of whaling made by a Japanese creator, and I'm kind of like, yeah, but whaling's kind of bad.
I had the same impression. I found it very, very difficult to separate myself from that, where it's like there's a lot going for this manga. Like, it's really beautiful. The characters are really interesting. Kind of as we were talking about in the Delicious in Dungeon episode, there's something really fascinating about a fantasy world where it's focused on everyday people.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's something that this comic does very well, that it's like these are people who it's their job to catch these dragons, and it's very much about their everyday life and their struggles in a challenging world. But yeah, I was overwhelmed with that aspect of, like, this is whaling. This is a romantic comic about whaling. And I struggled with it.
I would argue with the perception of it being romantic. Like, for me, I feel like the world is presented as fairly harsh, and that these people are working people. I don't know if that element, some people would perceive it as romantic. I didn't necessarily. But, and also it's like, I don't know. Like, I always am a little bit concerned when it's like, well, this is a fantasy novel that is obviously an analogy for something else. And it's like, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't like to assume that it is necessarily. Especially because, like, I've done fantasy and I've had people assume that it was an analogy for something, and it was absolutely not. So, you know, I've had experience with that. And sometimes you just walk into it. You know, like, sometimes as an author, you don't necessarily see that analogy can be made. And then the book is published and other people point it out, and it's like, oops. You know? Yeah. So, I didn't want to assume. I felt like it was possibly, you could say it was similar to whaling, but I didn't want to assume that this was an apologetic screed for it or anything like that. I actually really liked the presentation of this, the culture of this world. Like, in volume two, the two main characters, I guess you could say they're the main characters. So we had Mika and then the new girl on the ship, Takeda. They go to meet this old guy in a city, and there's this like whole little hut that is basically made, and it's covered with all these patches of different dragons. So there's like this whole history.
Yeah, I liked the the Mallow Tows, I guess they call themselves.
Oh, yes. Like,
they were really interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, like there's this whole history that goes back thousands and thousands of years of these people hunting these dragons. And, you know, then they make these special patches out of the skin. And oh, I'm looking at the wrong book. That's my one.
Yeah,
I've got the page here. I'll do a quick screenshot for later.
I feel like I enjoyed the second volume more. Mm-hmm. Maybe because it was less about hunting down whales and more that we're spending time with these characters in a village. And
yeah,
the one dragon that they do fight is like, it's attacking the village, so, I mean, it's self-defense.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that Volume 2, I think it picked up a little more because the danger of the dragon felt a little more apparent. They paid a lot of lip service to the dangers about dragons in Volume 1, but I feel like when the dragon actually starts firing, I don't know, its heat ray from its wings or whatever it was doing, and just starts destroying the town, like, I mean, we could talk about how it ended up there injured in the first place, but it's like, here it is, it's destroying the town, it has to be dealt with, at this point they have to kill it. And I think something that would help this story in my mind is establishing a little more the dangerousness of these dragons, that like, we can't just let dragons fly around or they're going to keep strafing our cities. Like, we have to take them out of the air.
In the first volume, they meet up with a representative of a village, and they're basically refused shelter. And then there's a report of a dragon nearby, and of course this representative immediately goes and begs them to fight this dangerous dragon. So I feel like that's especially where like the whaling analogy breaks down, because it's like, whales are not a threat to human beings,
right.
Whereas that's dragons right. are, you know, yeah. like, these right. are presented as dangerous yeah. creatures.
Yeah, and that's why I think if there was more,
yeah.
more of that danger was apparent, like maybe lead with, oh no, we got here too late and the whole town's been wiped out, like, I think that would sort of like earn the hunting of the dragons a little more. Like, it's like, oh, well, we've seen the aftermath of what happens when you don't kill a dragon, so we definitely have to deal with this. This is a huge problem, you know?
Yeah.
But instead it leans kind of more on their deliciousness.
Yes.
Which again kind of takes me out of the work. And so it's really funny contrasting this with Delicious and Dungeon, where... And I read them in the opposing order. So I read Drifting Dragons first, and it had kind of this recipe aspect, and I'm like, I cannot care. I don't care. And then Delicious and Dungeon, I'm like, okay, this recipe aspect I actually really enjoy. So it's really interesting how the same mechanic had such completely different effects on me, at least.
I mean, that shows the difference in the approach to a story that cartoonists can have, you know. The effect on the reader is a really important aspect.
And it might be, part of this might be a function of the way the manga industry works, where you really have to hook readers in the first chapter, and so the first chapter isn't necessarily, we talked about this last episode too, how it's not necessarily a good indication of where the story is going. So, I mean, I don't know, I think there's still room maybe for what we think these dragons are at the start of the story to turn out to be something totally different. Kind of the other thing I compare this to a lot is Nausicaa.
Yeah.
The drawing style is clearly Nausicaa inspired.
Yeah.
Agreed, sure. Yeah.
So maybe the story will be too. Maybe we'll find out the dragons are more than they seem, and then the sort of the dynamic of the characters will change.
There was the one dragon they hunted that had an eye, and I can't remember her name, but...
Oh, the one that they kind of just left?
The
glowing
one? She looks it in the eye, and then later on she's thinking back to the eye. Like, it's sort of... Is it Takita?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Takita, who's like the new shipmate on this ship, she has an up-close encounter with one of these dragons, and she looks it in the eye, and then they do kill it, but then, like, later on she's thinking back to that, and I sort of feel like maybe she was starting to have reservations about what she's doing. Like, she's like, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have killed that dragon, you know? Like, I feel like they're maybe laying that foundation. I don't know. Maybe I have to find out by Volume 3. But that's potential.
There is also a scene where there's a dragon off in the distance who's kind of, like, legendary for being glowing and very big, that they kind of see in the distance and kind of leave alone because they don't want to deal... They're not prepared to deal with a dragon that big.
Well... Mika would have dealt with it. Mika wanted to eat the whole thing.
He clearly would have wanted to eat it. but he's not the captain of the ship. So the ship is, as far as the ship is concerned, like, no, we're leaving that one alone. So that might be some kind of foreshadowing as well. It's hard to say at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, okay, so unrelated, but you guys can tell me if you had this problem or not, but I kept getting Mika and Gerard confused.
Really?
I did a little bit. Mika has, like, a stronger character to his face. But, like, it definitely, they blended a little bit together. And Takeda and Van?
Yeah.
As
yeah.
well? Vanny?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, their character designs are too similar. And so in the end of Volume 2, when Gerard gets a haircut, I was like, thank you. Thank
See,
you.
I did not have that reaction at all. I was going to actually say that I thought, and how it was great how easy it was to tell the characters apart, despite the fact that they're all wearing a uniform and are all about the same build. Like, their faces, generally speaking, are, like, pretty different and pretty distinctive.
They're distinct enough to distinguish, but yeah. not if you're trying to read it quickly because the book okay. makes you uncomfortable.
Sure, that's fair. Like, having different haircuts later on, I'm sure will help.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a while to be like, okay, Vanny always has the ponytail and Takeda always has the braids. It's
there's
like,
also
okay,
a lot
sure.
of characters to keep track of.
But there was the scene where they were in the brothel, like Gerard and some of the guys were in the brothel. And
are you sure it's Gerard? Because I thought it was Giro. Am I wrong? Giraud?
Giro?
Let me see.
Or Giro? I don't know.
I
wrote it down as Giro, but...
G-I-R-A-U-D, right?
Wait, Giro.
Oh, they have the characters at the start of it. Let me find it.
They
don't have their names. Yeah. Never mind.
I might be wrong. I was writing it down, like, before I came out here.
Giro...
I thought it was Giro, but yeah. I might be wrong.
Mika and Giro, I mean, sure, but yeah, anyways, Giro is at the brothel, and, like, he gets into, like, an altercation with someone, but then he immediately, like, kind of, like, backs down, and I was like, that doesn't seem like, oh, wait, sorry, I'm thinking of Mika. Like, I was like, he's acting out of character, and I was like, oh, no, he's acting within character, I'm just getting my characters confused.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to tell them apart when they're together, because Mika's so much taller.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
I definitely, I had the same kind of moment of, like, oh, Giraud in isolation is, like, very different from Mika. I actually really like Giraud's character, though.
Yeah.
Like, I think he had a lot of interesting lore and backstory to him, with, like, the history of his father, who actually was an absent father, because he got so attracted to drinking and the lifestyle, but then ended up following in his footsteps anyway, despite that strange history. So I thought that was neat.
Yeah, and then the interactions with him and the woman in the village, mm-hmm. that was really interesting. I liked that. That was a...
Yeah, Katja.
Yeah.
Yeah, Katja was a good
complex.
Character.
Yeah. Yeah. She's got some just, interesting complications.
Like, yeah, I wanted her to go with them. Like, I thought that would have been fun.
See, I thought that's how it was going to go, or I thought, yeah. oh, well, they're going to, like, get together. But then they kind of just, like, spend a bunch of time hanging out, and then she, like, sneakily takes a lock of his hair.
Yeah.
Which, that's cool. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like she knows that this is her life.
Yeah.
You know? And
there's a lot,
like,
of depth there that's maybe not stated explicitly, but you can kind of imply it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the art is really good.
The art is fantastic.
I love the drawings a lot. So, working primarily in comics for younger readers, it's like, generally, your comics have to be in color. Like, you know, that's just sort of what kids expect nowadays, and I don't know. Like, I had one book that did well in black and white, this book called Friends with Boys, but for the most part, I find that books that initially started out as black and white tend to get rejected by kids nowadays because everything, you know, television and, you know, movies and animated shows and everything, it's all in color. So that's, I just find that that's what they expect. But reading this book, it's like, oh man, you know, I really wish I could do a black and white book because it's just like my favorite style of black and white, just a beautiful, like, scratchy pen drawings.
Yeah,
and
it's almost etching,
yeah,
in the way
yeah.
that it's hatched.
It's really gorgeous. Yeah, and then there's scenes where, especially in Volume 2, when they go to this town and they stay there for a few days, and this is just, yeah, the pages here, where Mika and Takeda are just, like, walking through the town, and it's just this beautiful little, I don't know, old world style fantasy town. I don't know, it's lovely and evocative, and yeah, I really wish that there was a market for this type of book that, you know, but done by a North American author. Because it just, I don't know, it just kind of feels like You know, you're sort of bound to it, to having to producing color work. I know that there are exceptions to that rule, of course, but that's just what I found over the course of my career.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
Well, I mean, I keep coming back to Nausicaa, and like, I'm
100%
convinced it's inspired by that. But given the fact that Miyazaki's not going to be drawing any more comics, it's different enough. You can tell, like, this is just someone who's a fan of Miyazaki. They're not trying to, like, ape it or, like, recreate it perfectly. They're just like, I want to do some of the same things that I remember from this book I liked. But, like, it's got all the things that I also like the best from that art, where it's got, like, that crosshatchy sort of etching style and, like, the weird creatures and, like, all these sort of... The cultural elements are really well done, where they're not generally, like... You can't say, oh, this is from this culture. It's, like, very sort of unique. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I think the vehicles are also really, really well done. Like, I really liked the way the airships were rendered and some of the other... There was, like, a helicopter car at one point. And the equipment, that's something that's really difficult to nail as an artist. And I thought it was really well done in this work.
Mm. And now you say Nausicaa, like, I really see it. I think the art, it took me a while to warm up to it, but I think that's because I read Delicious in Dungeon first, and this just felt so much, like, grittier and kind of, I don't know, like, yeah, almost messier and compared
to,
like,
kind of a grittier story, though.
Yeah, well, yeah. It suits the story. It suits the story, but just, like, I guess I'd come right out of this really clean, friendly, like, appealing character design sort of story, and then now it's, like, much more realistic, much more, like, crosshatched. Like, characters are much more similar looking. Like, you don't have every character as a completely unique kind of shape. Like, so it took me a while to warm up to it. But, yeah, actually, I think, especially the way the dragons and the airships are rendered, I think that was really good stuff.
Like, for me, looking at this, it's like, this is actually how I wish I could draw. Because it's like, there's a looseness to it. Like, my work is very... I don't know. I mean, again, this is just me looking at my own work, so it's, like, my perception of my own work, and it's, like, I see the work that goes into it, I see the hours that I spent, and my perception of this work is, of course, incorrect, because I'm not the person that drew it, so for all I know, this artist, you know, worked as hard as I did, but it's, like, it looks easy. It looks like it just sort of, like, flowed out of them, and that's something that, as a creator, I get super jealous of, because, mm-hmm. like, for me, drawing is, like, really hard. Like, it's really hard. It's time-consuming. I have to spend a lot of time doing it. Like, in order for me to produce a book, it's, like, I have to put hours and hours into it. It's not easy for me to do, even at this point when I've been drawing, like, over half my life. And then looking at this, it's, like, it feels effortless. Like, there's something about it that feels very easy. And, I mean, again, that is just my perception as the person who did not draw it. But I don't know. There's like an ease to it that I'm really jealous of. I would like to just be able to sit down and dash off pen drawings. And I've seen people do it. There are some people that are gifted in that way and they're just able to do it. But I am not that person. And I'm always jealous of anyone who I perceive has that very particular skill.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about Tilly Walden.
Yeah, my God, I would just jumped into my mind as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, like, because her art is just so quick and so expressive, and, like, every single line has, like, so much importance to it, but, like, I can't draw like that. I gotta draw every brick. I can't stop myself.
She draws straight to ink.
Yeah.
She draws straight to ink. It's incredible. I really want to get her new one. I forget the name, but it's on my list.
Okay.
I found out that Chris Ware doesn't do thumbnails. Or scripts. Like, he just starts... I'll just start on the top corner and just kind of figure out how the page is going to end.
I'm still not convinced that he's being 100% honest when he says that. That's not possible.
Anything is possible.
Yeah. Well, maybe he's, like, put a lot of thought in his head first, and he just sees the page, and then he, like, executes.
I mean, I guess that would be the only alternative, but that still seems hard.
Yeah. It was. I definitely think I get picked up in volume two, like the big kind of, I don't know, showdown with the injured dragon in the city. Like, that really felt like I was really needed. Like, I was gripped by that. I was like, are they gonna solve this problem? Are they gonna, like, is everyone gonna make it? Is someone gonna die? Like, I actually thought Mika might kick the bucket.
I also like the sort of the politics of between the two airship crews.
Oh yeah, and they had to like sign contracts order to band together to take down this dragon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I thought that was
they
really
have to decide ahead of time who gets what portion and how much. Because like that's what whaling would have been too, is like everyone's got a contract, you're in this because you need to make a living at it, you need to decide who gets what, and if it's an unfair system then everything's going to fall apart. And I kind of like too that ultimately they decide that they have to give the dragon to the village because the village has been destroyed. And they decide not because they're being altruistic, but because they're being practical, that if we don't give this dragon to this village, they're going to never want to do business with us again, and that's going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like, again, this... It's a little bit similar to Delicious in Dungeon. It's like this hits a type of fantasy that I personally really enjoy, which is it is about, like, working men and women. It's about people, ordinary people, like, living within this complicated fantasy world. And, like, that appeals to me so much more than stories about, like, kings and queens and, you know, like... Mm-hmm. Popes and, I mean, you know, things like that. I don't know, maybe that show The Young Pope is good. I don't know, I haven't watched it. But, I don't know, like, I'm always very, very interested in that perspective when it comes to a fantasy story. And that was initially, you know, what drew me to it.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. I agree. Like, I think as much as I like Lord of the Rings, I don't think it's a good choice for every author who comes after to do the same thing where it's about a king who's returning to reclaim his crown.
Yeah.
Like, no, I want to know, like, this isn't something that comes from the books, but it is something that seems to be the case in the movies where, apart from the hobbits, you never see a farm. And, like, if this is supposed to be a realistic medieval-type world, people need to eat, and, like, 95% of people are going to be invested in, like, their job is generating food, so why don't we see that?
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is consistent in that sense where it's like there are industries and there's sort of there's business deals and there's this sort of like
there's a whole economy.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Harvesting these dragons.
Uh-huh. And it makes sense.
Yeah. I would actually be kind of interested in knowing a little more about the structure of the societies in this world. Like, is everything just like an individual kind of village fiefdom, or is there like an overarching, like, is there a king somewhere? Like, we don't need to have the story be about the king, but like, I'd be interested to know, like, is there a king?
Is this all happening within one country, or are they crossing international borders to chase dragons? Is there jurisdiction?
Yeah.
Is there a place where hunting dragons is illegal? Like, oh, it'd be interesting to know.
Yeah, that would be. I would like to see that, And I assume that there will be more of that in later volumes. You know, one thing that was nice about Delicious in Dungeon is, like, you know, I'd gotten to read, like, 6 volumes, so I knew, you know, where the story was going, not just based on volumes 1 and 2, but with this one, it's like, I don't know where it's going. I've only read volume 1 and 2. And that's, you know, really why I recommend, like, giving a new manga series, like, at least 2 or 3 volumes before you decide it's not for you. Because it's just, you just don't know. Again, it's like the structure of, you know, like, when I do my books, it's like, because of how our publishing system works, it's like, it's usually like 1 and done, or if you're very, very lucky, you get to do maybe 3 books in a series, but like, everything is planned out ahead of time, because like, that's just how publishing works in graphic novels and in novels. But it just feels very, very different in Japan, where just everything is serialized. And like, I'm always curious about I assume that most mangaka have like an endpoint in mind, but if their manga gets popular, like, do they deviate from that endpoint? Do they, like, go off in different directions in order to pursue different ideas, you know, to prolong the story? I mean, I don't know, like, the guy that does One Piece, like, he's been saying he's halfway through the story for, like, the past 10 years, you know? And that how many volumes is in that series? It's like, over 100,
yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, but he's been, like, at the halfway point for, like, 30 volumes, you know?
Like, yeah.
But it's like, that manga is so popular, and it's like, you know, you don't want to completely end something. I don't know. That's that popular. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not in that position.
Yeah. And you can correct me if I've got this wrong, but I think artist for Dragon Ball Z has tried to like end the series multiple times, and then the editor keeps saying, "No, no, you have to continue. It's too popular. You can't stop."
I've heard that story. Yeah, like,
figure out a way to keep it going.
Yeah.
So he reached his ending like halfway back.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's just the end of Dragon Ball.
Yeah. I just don't know what that's like to like continue.
It's got to be a really difficult challenge.
Yeah, it seems really hard to me.
Naruto had the same problem. I think it went on 10 years longer than the author originally wanted. Yeah.
And like I read about 12 volumes of Naruto, and does it go to like 80 volumes?
I think it's about, yeah, it's about 70 something.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's like I read 70, those 12 volumes were amazing, like really really good. But I kind of looked at the rest of it, and I'm like, there's no way this guy can sustain this over 70 something volumes. So I'm just going to enjoy these 12, you know, and you know, maybe just read a couple more if it occurs to me. But this is great, like, but I mean, just from the perspective of a North American cartoonist, it's like to have 12 volumes of anything be that successful, mm-hmm. and both as a storytelling, you know, as a story, and then also as like a published work that sells millions of copies. Like, that's just unfathomable to me.
Yeah, it's a very different perspective. I think North American creatives look at like a much shorter window.
Yeah.
Because even Bone, like, were there like 8 volumes of Bone or something? Like, that's really, really long by North American standards.
Yeah. And it took him 12 years to do those.
Yeah.
I think is it 8 or 9?
I think it's 9.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel bad. It's like one of my favorite comics, but yeah, it's been a while since I read it. And now I have like the 1 volume edition that's like 3,000 pages long.
And then Scott Pilgrim 2, that's like 6 volumes. Six. And then it's like, I can't think of another, like, apart from Bone and Scott Pilgrim, I can't think of another series that's like that long.
Superhero comics are the only things that break that, where it's like they're constantly coming back to like the retconning, they're like tying things in.
It'll
and
never
so
end.
It's one 20 year long story, but it's different because it's got so many different artists.
Yeah. And it's like, it's owned by this corporation as opposed to like being a creative work. Like, Scott Pilgrim is like a good example of something that's very, very unusual in North American publishing, where it's like a creator-owned work. And then it came out like really, really fast. Like, he did it in less than 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm actually really curious if he's ever going to publish anything else.
He's done other stuff.
No. But that was like back in 2013, I think?
He's writing another series.
He did
called
Snot Girl. Yeah, he's writing Snot Girl.
I'm just wondering if he's ever going to do another. Oh,
anything
like drawing
that big.
It. Mm. Like, no, just like drawing it.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I just feel like if you churn out work that quickly, it's like you burn out, and then it's just like, oh my God. I don't know. I
could be.
I would be very tired.
Right.
I'm not worried about Brian. I think he's set.
Yeah. But it's, I don't know. I feel like it's kind of like a blessing and a curse if your work gets that popular.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like, I mean, like you hear this in novel writing too, right? It's like the woman who wrote Anne of Green Gables, like by the end of her career, she was just like, I never want to see that redheaded witch again.
Yeah, Conan Doyle as well with Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
Sherlock got
he
so popular.
Him.
Yeah, he killed him, and then his fans were like, you can't.
Yeah. So then he had to bring him back and then write more. And like,
I feel like part of the problem is like writing pays so poorly that like audiences can hold that over your head. Like, you need to write more because, like, otherwise you have no money.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's like you look at, like, J.K. Rowling, right? She did Harry Potter, and she's like, okay, I'm done with that. I'm going to write this other thing. And then it flops, and then she goes, actually, I've got more Harry Potter.
Yeah. It's fraught.
I mean, I feel like I'm all the people.
J.K. Rowling.
She doesn't
need
work.
Yeah, fair enough.
She does have more money than the queen. But yeah, no, I mean, I don't know what it's like to have an experience of creating something that people loved so much. Like, I feel like that is possibly, I mean, that's got to be something you consider. It's not just the money. It's just that people really love this thing that I made. And as a creator, like, that's incredibly flattering, you know? And there is something really wonderful about that. I don't know. Like, I just haven't had that experience, you know?
I think it is a different experience. Like, it's not one that I've had, but, like, I read about people like Toby Fox, where Undertale, like, completely blew up, or even Homestuck with Andrew Hussey. Like, your relationship to your fandom changes, and it's strange, I think.
Yeah. So anyway, Drifting Dragons.
Yeah.
has not yet achieved that level of popularity.
No, definitely not. I did say that there was a manga, or just, no, sorry, there's a Netflix anime being made of it, but, so at first I was excited, because I liked the art style so much, and then I went and looked at the trailer, and it's 3D.
Oh.
And it looks like the art style as much as 3D animation can, but I was very disappointed. I really wanted it to be, like, hand-drawn, and, like, sketchy-looking, and... I don't know, it just wasn't.
That's a trend I don't know what I feel about. Like, because Dorohedoro is also coming out, and it's also that kind of 3D look, and Land of the Lustrous as well. Like, I'm like, I just don't like it.
Imagining someone pitching this to Studio Ghibli. Like,
yeah.
Whale Hunters in the Sky, come on. Like,
I think the problem is if Nausicaa was in this story, she would be on the side of the dragons.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, Miyazaki would be like, okay, only if I get to flip it around and have the dragons take over.
It also feels a little weird to me. I mean, I don't know how many volumes are available in Japanese. It might be quite a lot farther along in Japanese, which that would sort of solve this problem. But, like, it seems weird to be doing a series when there's only 3 books. So I hope that there's a lot more in Japanese that they can base it on rather than just kind of stealing the premise and then just going in their own direction. Because I have a personal grudge against any time someone, like, makes a movie out of a book that's not finished yet.
Yeah. I mean, it says, so at the back it says that Volume 1 was originally published in 2016 in Japan. Okay. So I assume... Because, you know, now we're in 2020, that there's a lot more published in Japanese.
That makes sense.
But yeah, it was not published in English until last year. That was when the first volume came out.
Okay. Do we want to do final thoughts?
This book was not for me. I think mechanically it's really strong. It's well written. It's well drawn. It's just not for me. unless it takes, like, a really, really sharp turn. So
yeah, I'd be curious. Like, I'd be curious. I'm planning to continue reading it, but maybe we can be back if like there's like a big reveal about the dragons and Nausicaa shows up and confronts these drakkers and stuff.
For the direction that the two books seem to be going in, it's not a journey I will continue, but I will keep the line open, I guess.
if this has like a Miyazaki twist, I think I would recommend this, but it's like, it's where we're at now. It's hard to say. It was really good world building. It was fascinating just how, I guess, like, a manga centered around food is just a thing you can do now. So you can just do Delicious and Dragon, or you can do Drifting Dragons.
Oh, yeah. No, I love the range of genres and cross genres that's possible in Japan. Like, if you pitched this book here, I don't think anyone would let you do it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Like, I just appreciate that you can just write a comic that just every once in a while pauses to go, like, did you know what they were eating? Here's how to make it. That's great. But yeah, I would say if I had to pick one, I think it's Delicious in Dungeon, I think, was more fun. And I felt like this was just a little too into just like the preparation and the butchering of the dragon carcasses. I could have like dialed that back a little bit. But yeah, if there's a turn in like volume 3, I think I would like to read that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with the group here that I'm going to hold off recommending or not recommending until I find out more what happens further down the road. Until then, I'm going to stick with seeing if I can actually get all the way through Moby Dick. Because you can't have a sense of how that one's going to end.
Happily ever after.
No.
The whale and Ishmael sailing off into the sunset together forever.
Holding hands.
I don't know. I mean, I really liked it. I feel like I was the most positive towards it, which is why I recommend it.
That's okay.
I brought it to this group. But I really enjoy this fantasy setting. I like the fact that it is not high fantasy, that it focuses on working people living in this fantasy world. I really appreciate that. I love the art a lot. I hope that the story will go in different directions. You know, I feel like there's things that I want from the story. But yeah, I'm going to continue to read it. I definitely recommend it. But again, maybe not for vegetarians.
Right on.
Okay. So, shout-outs?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, do I have to think of something else?
So, if you can think of something else.
I'm Jeff Ellis. You can find my work at jeffreyellis.ca. Got some new pages that I just posted. And I'm going to shout out I'm Not Okay With This, which just came out on Netflix, and it's based on a comic by Charles Forsman. And I feel like I need to start reading comics by Charles Forsman because he keeps getting his comics turned into Netflix miniseries.
Fair. Yeah. I'm Jam. My comic at wastedtalent.ca updates Tuesdays and Thursdays. By now, my next comic, Shenzhen Fast, should be launching pretty soon, so follow me on Twitter to get updates about that. I'd like to shout out a comic I've been reading called Land of the Lustrous. Have I shouted this out yet? It's a really interesting manga that's been coming out recently. It also got this adaptation in 3D that I don't know how I feel about, but the manga is really interesting. It's a lot about identity and body horror, and it's far future fantasy, and it's very strange.
I'm Jonathan. You can find my work at phobos-comic.com. And I'm going to shout out Moby Dick by Herman Melville. It's a long book, and I'm only able to read it because I'm listening to it as an audiobook while I draw. And it's weird, and this is my second attempt, but it's worth the attempt because it's just so unique. I don't think there's anything else that's quite like this book.
I'm Faith Erin Hicks. So you can find me at faitherinhicks.com. I'm on some of the social medias, Instagram and Twitter mostly, as Faith Erin Hicks. You know what? I'm going to shout out a podcast because I've been listening to some podcasts this past week as I draw comics. I listened to Lindsay Ellis. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but she's a YouTube critic. I love her criticism of film and media. It's very, very thoughtful. And she has a new podcast called Musical Splaining that is basically her inflicting musicals on a friend who does not care for them, and with hilarious results. And there aren't very many episodes up right now, but there was a discussion of Frozen the musical with another YouTube critic, Jenny Nicholson, and it was amazing. And
well, that's the ultimate team up. Both of their YouTube channels are so good.
Yeah, I know, right? It was amazing, and had some really good discussion about like why Frozen in particular, Frozen the movie, and Elsa in particular, are so appealing to young girls.
So our next one is going to be Saga. We are going to be reading the graphic novel collections Volume 1, 2, and 3, which have been collected together into Book 1 Deluxe.
The Trade Waiters is brought to you by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can follow us at tradewaiters.com, as well as iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.